We're speaking with Gabriela Lev, longtime performer, writer, creative personality in the Jerusalem theater world, group called Theater Company Jerusalem. And in the past, it was a group, it was an all-women's theater company. Is this still true, Gabi?
No. In fact, we were never all women's. We were always interested in women's issues, which we still are. But I think from the very beginning, we worked also with men, very closely with men. In fact, Bruria, our first piece, was produced by Stephen Solomons, a man. We had men musicians who were performing with us in the beginning. And we've grown from then, that was in 1983, to now where we're associated with more than 100 artists. We've created more than 28 original works. We perform all over the world, including Japan, India, Korea, Poland, Sweden, Hungary, Russia, to name just a few. We have performed in the States, lately less so. We did perform in the States a lot around 10 years ago, and now we do less. I don't know why exactly. Maybe you can fill me in on that, what's happened in America. But we do, what interests us is the woman's voice. The woman's voice, particularly in the sources, in the Jewish sources, because one has to listen very carefully to hear her voice. As we know, our sources were written by men. The Talmud, the Zohar even, which is a very feminist document, but it was written by men. And so we have in the years come to address this issue, even though I don't think this was our initial impulse.
One of the unique things about your group is that you work in both English and Hebrew. And I assume that comes from the fact that both you and your sister, who's also part of the group, are original English speakers.
That's right. And also Joyce Miller, who was originally part of Professor Joyce Miller. She was from South Africa originally. So she was also an Anglo-Saxon. I think that because of that, and also because right from the very beginning we were invited to perform. The first person that invited us was Robert Alter, the art of the biblical narrative, Professor Robert Alter, who was then, I think he maybe still is, Professor of Comparative Literature in California at Berkeley. And I remember he saw Bruria then in 1984 or 5. And he wrote, I think it was in the New York Times, this was the most exciting theatrical experience I had in my year's stay in Israel. But I remember he came backstage afterwards and he said, you must come to Berkeley to speak about your methods. And of course we didn't have any methods. We just created this one piece. And so I said to the other people in the group, listen, we better create methods so we can go to Berkeley and talk about it. But the reason that I tell this story is right from the beginning, because of the requests that came to us, we were self-reflective. And therefore, as soon as you're self-reflective, you're also educational. As soon as you look at what you've done and think about how you've done it, and think about what effect it has and what the future is, then we're right in the realm of education, although I do believe that all art is educational.
The series of plays that I saw, Bruria and the play about Esther, are about very powerful women in the Jewish tradition. Are there other women in the Jewish tradition that you've dealt with?
Yeah, we've dealt with Sarah, the great mother, the first mother of the Jewish people, and of course the irony of the fact that she was barren. If we look at the Mesopotamian mothers of this basin, the fertility symbols, they all have millions of breasts and millions of children. But our mother is barren. So we look at that, and we look at the sacrifice of her only son, or the near sacrifice, although there are midrashim which tell us that Yitzchak was in fact sacrificed. We've also done pieces on the nameless women in the Talmud. Well, they're nameless, but they're the wife of famous rabbis, or they're the whore, the virgin, the hag. It's very interesting. Look, to be fair, a lot of men are also nameless in the Talmud. Ha'isha zeh, you know, this man, this bachur. But there are a lot of men who have names. The sages all have names. Whereas their wives, who often in these stories are the ones who teach them, don't have names, are nameless. So again, we were looking at these stories and trying to understand what is the feminine principle here, and being able to perform in English as well quite easily. We translate our own works, has opened many doors. Ironically, though, not the doors to English-speaking people living in Jerusalem. So maybe it's true that one cannot be a prophet in one's own city, because we do perform, as I said, worldwide. The amount of Anglo-Saxon people that come to see us in Jerusalem is just a fraction of the Anglo-Saxon population. So I'm really hoping that this series will be an opportunity for people to come and to meet us. We're a small theatre company. We're interested in the community. We're interested in meeting our audience and not just performing to this black, anonymous space. And in fact, in one of the performances, we invite audience reaction in Love Stories from the Talmud. So I'm really excited about it and looking forward to it.
What conclusions have you come to or understandings of the place of women in the Jewish tradition, particularly in the Talmud and in the Torah?
Well, it's interesting because there is a dialogue and a dichotomy here. On the one hand, women are Baruch Shelo Asani Isha, right? We know that. And there are prayers that a man says every morning, I think 18, and one of them is, thank you, blessed be the Lord who did not make me a woman. It's particularly poignant because it comes right before or right after the blessing, blessed be the Lord who didn't make me a slave. So we can see who women are associated with and why exactly the man blesses the Lord for not making him a woman. But if we look at the Jewish tradition, women have a very, very strong position. It's like the Italian mother. In Mediterranean culture altogether, but particularly in Jewish culture, it's the woman who defines who will be a Jew. Also halachically, also I believe in the family, also in the traditional Jewish family, and I believe also in the more contemporary Jewish family, it's the woman that decides things, particularly family matters, even if it's not vocally, like the joke, he may be the head, but I'm the neck, you know, moving the head. So it's an interesting dynamic that in the stories and in the legends, women seem to be taking a subservient role. But if you really listen to the stories and look at them, you will see that, first of all, there is a criticism, extreme criticism of the male and of male energy, often. And the woman is, as in the story of Sarah, where Sarah says, you must send Hagar away to Abraham, and God says, listen to Sarah's voice. I think that he's not just talking about this instance. I think what the scripture is saying is, you must listen for the woman's voice, because it's not, the woman's voice in our tradition is not the linear voice of the march of history. That's the male voice. The woman's voice is the ambivalent voice underneath the subtext, which is far more interesting, especially far more interesting for the artist.
You're doing a series now in Jerusalem. Can you tell us a little bit about each of the plays that are coming up?
Yes, certainly, I'd love to. The first play is Shulem. This is a play that I wrote and was created in some way in memory of my father. My father was called Shulem, Zichrono Levracha. As I was growing up, I would hear these stories that came from a different place. They were actually stories of my parents' and my family's experiences in the Holocaust. Now, normally when you say Holocaust, immediately you think grey, black, depression, horror, trauma. All this is true, but when I was growing up, I also received a tremendous amount of life out of these stories because they were always very unusual and funny. I'll tell you one. We just arrived to Auschwitz and I was looking out of the carriage and I was seeing all these crazy people wandering about without hair and with these striped schmatas on, and I thought to myself, who are these crazy people? And then they took me and they shaved my head and they put me in the same striped schmatas, and suddenly a woman was running towards me with hands outstretched and she was screaming my name, Leitushkam, Leitushkam, and I thought, who is this Meshigana? And then I saw it was my sister. I didn't recognize her. And then we hugged and we laughed and we kissed and we cried. And I said, no, this is the first time in my life when I got a free haircut. All the stories that I bring, this is a story I heard from my aunt, Laichu. And the stories that I heard at home were always truncated, short. Never linear. This was the beginning and this was the end. They sort of came out of nowhere. And they always had a funny twist to them. Perhaps my family didn't tell me the real horror stories, you know, that those I found out from literature. I think this sense of humor and this incredible talent for life is what not only saved them, but what saved us, the Jewish people. And therefore, the performance Shulem, while not belittling the horror, comes at what the Holocaust has left us from a slightly different angle. And it's very, very dear work to me because it's also a personal work. And it's also, I think it's a timely work now when we're asking ourselves how do you continue to tell the story? You know, we have the Yad Vashem and we have the documentaries, but if it remains at that level, we all know as Jewish people that it will die. Because one has to re-enliven tradition all the time. So we're opening with this on the 29th of May. It's actually in 7 languages, but because this is the way I heard the stories. There, it's in English, Hebrew, German, Russian, Yiddish, Czechoslovakian, I think that's it, German also, but the performances that we do, that we will do here and that we do overseas in festivals, we've performed this in Poland and in Germany, very interesting experience performing this in Germany, have as the base language English. And when we perform in Hebrew, the base language is in Hebrew, but all the other languages are there to give a music and to give a feeling. And also, in some way, we're all children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren of immigrants, of refugees. And this history comes in through the sound of the different languages. And the audience here sits around a Pesach Seder table because the telling of the going out of Egypt, of the movement from slave to a free man, is paralleled in the coming out of the concentration camp. But there's a tremendous amount of color and humor and music and dance in this interpretation of these stories. So that is on the 29th. I really hope that people can come. And then we have every Tuesday night at 9, a different a piece of ours. I think then there's Esther. And then the week after that...
You have a unique approach to Esther. It's like no other Megillah reading I've ever experienced.
Thank you. Yeah, Esther is... you see, Esther is also Holocaust influenced. We saw Esther as a description of the feminine consciousness and how it works in the world of Esther. And we saw it as Esther writing herself, the goddess Esther. Why do I say the goddess Esther? Because in the Talmud tractate, Megillah, where they discuss Esther, they say the name comes from Ashtoret, the Sumerian goddess of love, and Isis, the Egyptian goddess of desire. So I didn't bring it in, they brought it in. And so we take this fact and say, yes, she was a goddess. And in some way, this is a manifestation of the Megillah, is the document, is a manifestation of one view of the universe. And Herve, it's not the only view. We all know that, you know, we're polemic and we all know that there are many views. But in this one view of the universe, she foresees the dangers of potential genocide, which in fact is almost happens in the Megillah, doesn't happen on Purim. That's why we celebrate Purim. But in fact, there is a law, laharog lahashmidu la'abed et kol ha'yehudim minar v'atzaken v'taf v'nashim, to obliterate, destroy and murder all the Jews from young man to old man, babies and women, and their property to be plundered. I mean, that could come out of the Third Reich, right? So she foresaw that possibility, and she foresaw the and she understood that if that idea of genocide exists, then you must have a document which will somehow warn people about how this possibility can be avoided, or what are the signs. And in her story, the order of the universe is overturned when the woman is weak. And the woman, the first woman in her story, is Vashti, the first queen. And when Vashti is beheaded, if you look at the Megillah, after Vashti is beheaded, after Mahuman asks for the removal of Vashti, he then comes and asks for the removal of the Jew. So when the receptive power is weak in the universe, in the cosmos, in the world. Receptive power, one can talk about it on a spiritual level. One can talk about it also on a political and social level. When the arts are weak, when listening is weak, when we talk too much in slogans and dogma, then the destructive power of Haman. Why is Haman destructive? Because he wants to be the king. He wants to be all-powerful. Evil wants power over everything. Only evil can exist. Evil will not let anything else exist. When the receptive power is weak, then this dark power has the space to come up and ask for the removal of the Jew, because once the Jew is removed, he is connected to the woman, then that's it. Then you have the woman is removed, the Jew is removed, it's very, very easy to remove the king, who here in the Megillah is also the clown. The Talmud tells us that Achashverosh, HaMelech Achashverosh, sometimes in the Megillah he's called HaMelech, sometimes it's called HaMelech Achashverosh. and there's a great discussion by the sages that God's name does not appear in the Megillah, which it doesn't. But the sages say that when in the Megillah it says only HaMelech, it's referring to the King of Kings. And when it says HaMelech HaChashverosh, it's referring to this foolish, drunken man who the Talmud in one of its jokes tells us that he kills his wife on the advice of his friend, and then later in the story kills his friend Haman on the advice of his wife, Esther, different wife. But in this world where Holocaust is possible, genocide is possible, then God is a fool. That is what Esther is telling us. And the interpretation goes on and shows, and in the piece, Esther, I'm now talking about the theatrical piece that we created, we do play scenes through this interpretation, and so you see, you see what is happening. And many people like you have said to me that after seeing our piece, they can never hear the Megillah in exactly the same way again.
And then after Esther, we'll have...
And then after Esther, we have a new piece that we're working on now called Love Stories of the Talmud. And these are the nameless women. I think all the women there are nameless that we deal with. They're short stories. Well, all the stories in the Talmud are short. That's the beauty of them. They're presented in very, very pithy form. Very condensed, yes, exactly. So the women here are called the wife of, or one woman is called a woman from Sidon. And it's all about relationships between men and women, between marriage, intimacy, even eros. And in this evening, we also want to learn. We want to share the experience of Chevruta learning with the audience in a limited way, but kind of a Bet Midrash theater. So there'll be a little bit, a taste of that, and then a performance of a story, and then another taste of interchange. So the audience will have a chance to reflect on these issues also in the light of rabbinic interpretation and contemporary opinion. So it should be very interesting.
One of my other favorite plays of yours, and a very exciting story, is the story of Bruria, which you've done. Can you tell us a little how you see that story and why you chose that? She's one of the women who's named, isn't she?
She's one of the few women who is named, and I think she's the only woman who's named as an authority. The halakha is learned as Bruria learns it. It's interesting, the halakha that she brings. She had a brother and a sister, and there is a halakha of what makes a oven kosher. Okay, and what makes an oven treif? And how can you re-kosher an oven? So the brother says, if you move the oven, you can re-kosher it, which is true. But Bruria says, if you dissemble it and then reassemble it, then you can also kosher. And the rabbis say, Yafeh Amra Bruria. Bruria has the more elegant solution because it's the more abstract one. It's talking about, deconstruction. Bruria had a tragic life, very, very tragic. She lived here after the destruction by the Romans of the Jewish temple, and where the Jews had to find other ways to remain a nation. Personally, her story is tragic. Her father was one of the 10 martyrs, and he was murdered by the Romans, burned actually, with the scrolls of the Torah wrapped about him. Her mother was also executed by the Romans. Her sister, so the Talmud tells us, was taken by the Romans to serve them as a Hebrew whore. Her brother was accused of being a traitor, so, you know, or an informer to the Romans, so we're not quite sure about him. She was married to the great Rabbi Meir, but he himself is a very ambivalent character, because the Talmud tells us that even though he was the greatest sage of his time, we do not learn the Talmud as he learns it, because one couldn't understand what he meant. Yes. So she's married to a very complex man in this very difficult time. The legend of a woman of valor who will find, tells us that this woman of valor is Bruria, because of the way she received the news of the death of her two sons. So her whole family really is obliterated. And of course the mystery of Bruria is how she herself dies, which is a mystery up till today. Rashi tells us that she made light of the saying of the wise that women are fickle-minded, because obviously she was not fickle-minded, as we have seen. So her husband, Meir, this very abstruse character, warns her and says, "The end of your days will bear witness to their words." And he orders one of his students to seduce Bruria. And the student tempter cajoled her day after day until she gave herself. And when she found out what had been done, she choked herself to death. And Rabbi Meir left the land from the heat of that shame. This is the story that Rashi brings, because Bruria's death is not explained in the Talmud. So he explains it this way. We did research on this story. Now, most of what Rashi brings is found in previous sources, because Rashi doesn't make sources up. And I think there are maybe 5 or 6 sources where there are no previous reference. Previous, what I mean by previous is before him. You have to understand that the whole body of our culture was created over something like 1,000 years. So Rashi, who lived in the Middle Ages, is commenting on what happened 500, 600 years, 700 years before him. And there is dialogue through all the different scholars or through all those times. When I first started learning the Talmud, I didn't understand this. I thought when it says, you know, Rabbi Yoshua, they're sitting in the same room, but they're not. They could be divided by 300 years. And just like now, I'm talking about Rashi as though he's my friend, but he's already been not with us for over 700 years, you know. So this is part of the dialogue of our tradition. And what I mean by previous source, I mean previous in time. And there's no previous source to this story of Bruria. So what could it be? So the obvious feminist answer is, well, Rashi made it up because the Jewish tradition could not bear to have such a famous woman scholar. But then if one looks at Rashi's personal life, and I think somebody's written 2 books, Rashi's Daughters, now it's very interesting. But if we look at Rashi's personal life, it is quite true that he had daughters and he was very encouraging of them to learn. And one cannot accuse Rashi of being misogynist. So that kind of rules that out. So we, you know, through the years, we've had, when we first started, there was a tremendous amount of anger against the tradition of the rabbis for having to question Bruria in this way. Because, you see, there's a wonderful, wonderful source in the Talmud, not Rashi's commentary, actually in the Talmud, about the evil inclination and its strength. And there's a story there that Rabbi Meir makes light, in fact, it almost uses the same, of the strength of the evil inclination. You know, the Yetzer Hara, you know, he is so powerful that Yetzer Hara will not be able to conquer him. And so what does Yetzer Hara do? Turns himself into a beautiful woman on the other side of the river and beckons to Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir wants to get to the other side of the river, but there's no boat. So what does he do? He throws a rope and he pulls himself through the water on the rope. And when he's halfway across the river, the Yetzer Hara reveals himself as the Yetzer Hara and says, all your Torah is not worth 2 zuzim. All your Torah is not worth, you know, 2 pennies against, you know, what? See what you've done. But then a voice comes down from heaven, Bat Kol, and says, we will spare Rabbi Meir because of his Torah, because of his previous worth. And our question is, well, what about Bruria's Torah? Why is the woman's Torah valued less than the man's Torah? They both failed in very similar tests. This question, you know, is re-answered at different times of our lives in different ways.
One of the things you alluded to that's interesting is, I know you've been doing these same pieces over and over again for years, literally, what, 20, almost 30 years now.
Yes.
Do they change for you? Do they change in the form of their presentation? I mean, do the lines change? Do the directions change?
That's a very interesting question. Well, they grow with you. We started with Bruria, we were young women, and therefore we had the passions of young women coming to a new country, trying to understand what we were doing here, trying to understand our position in this new culture for us, new old culture. But you see, this is the beauty of great texts, all great texts, whether it be Euripides or Shakespeare or the Talmud, that you can come back to them and you can read them again. I mean, obviously, we do this all the time. T.S. Eliot is a wonderful example. You read them again at different times of your life and you suddenly see different things in them. They're the same words. The poem hasn't changed, but in fact it has. And this is the nature of great texts, that they are almost organic, and they almost, because of the energy of the garin, of the seed of which they were, they are almost organic. They change with you. So when you come to speak these texts, well, I'm talking about the Talmud, Bruria is 90% the Talmud and the Midrash. Very little added material, which was written by Eliza Elyon Yisraeli, who unfortunately passed away in September, just this last September, a founding member and a writer of our company. But Bruria is 90% text from the Talmud and the Midrash. So speaking this text, in fact, already has a power, because if we remember, this text was originally oral. It was originally oral law. It was only written down. Yehuda Nasi, some 500 years, 600 years later, did he start to collate it. So it was an oral tradition for at least 500 years. That's a long time, many generations. And therefore, reverting back to the original form in which this knowledge was given over already has an incredible power, and it works on you very similar to the ways that holy sounds work on you. They work on different parts of your body and different parts of your consciousness, and they go through you and out to the audience. Therefore, one tries to do as little as possible.
But you guys are so dramatic.
Yes, it's true. But one tries to allow the natural drama of the stories are dramatic, and those stories that I told you about her whole family. One tries to allow the natural power and the natural drama to be revealed without doing too much. And I think this is the difference between what you said, what you told me about the film Bruria, which I haven't seen, in which they translated into modern terminology. See, we left it. We left it. We're modern. The performers are modern. I'm not going to pretend that I'm, 700 years old, although in some way my consciousness is, yes. But I'm not. I'm a contemporary person that lives. It's enough. I don't have to transform the story into a contemporary story so that an audience is intelligent. They can do that transformation. What I have to do is I have to be a vessel in order to transmit this knowledge. And the vessel changes because a 24-year-old woman isn't the same as a 50-year-old woman. I'm a grandmother now. And when I started, I did have children. I had children. But when I started research on Bruria, I didn't have children. Different things come out and we surprise ourselves often in performance, not by the way we change the words, but by the way we understand the words differently, and therefore they come out differently. So it's always very interesting. People say to us, don't you ever get tired of performing it? You've been performing it for 30 years or 20 years or however long we've been before, and many years. No, I never get tired of Bruria. I never get tired of it. I think partly because it was the first, and the love of the first, and also because the language is so beautiful. The language is the language. You're saying something more than the story. You're telling something more than the story through the language. And we are doing Bruria now. When are we doing Bruria? I think we're doing it on the 2nd of June. So people should definitely come then, because that's seeing history. I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to do Bruria. We are now working, as I said, with we did a new piece for the Israel Festival 2009, but I direct, and they're all with new actors. Bruria is still the original, piece. So when I say I don't know how much longer I mean it. So people should come and see it. It's a great opportunity. June the 2nd.
And what are you going to be performing at the Israel Festival? That sounds interesting.
Well, we performed last year Rondo, which was a piece that Eliza wrote, and it was a contemporary piece about her life, actually. And when we started doing it, we knew that Eliza was very, very ill. So it was really a very special work. We're doing it again now in Yafo at the end of June. This will be in Hebrew, but it's so visual and so full of music and 13 performers. Yeah, we usually don't do big pieces, but this is a big piece. And it's out in the courtyard in the middle of the old city of Yafo, opposite the sea, outside the Jewish Arab Theater. It's a beautiful courtyard. So it's definitely, definitely worth coming. 23rd, 24th, 25th of June. It's an event. It's a happening. This year we will probably be doing something for the Israel Festival, but seeing they have not announced, I can't really say what we're going to be doing.
Okay. In any event, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Gabriela, and I look forward to seeing the plays I haven't seen, and I look forward to seeing the plays again that I have seen.
One more thing. We do travel, as I said, so we're very interested in traveling. This year we're going to Ireland and Hungary and perhaps Romania. But if there are any listeners who, you know, I'm sure there's a way to get in touch with you, right? And you'll pass it on to us. So just keep that in mind.
Wonderful. Thank you again.